Welcome to Make Your Wealth Work, the podcast where wealth becomes your greatest ally in achieving your dreams.
Hello, I'm Joe Pantozzi, and we're with Make Your Wealth Work. And I've got the privilege today of having Tom Gober with me. And Tom is with Deep Dive Analytics. I'm going to let you explain more about his credentials, but in essence, he is a certified fraud examiner who has been doing his work really protecting the consumer for a number of decades. So how you doing, Tom? It's good to see you.
Excellent. Good to see you, Joe. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your background, how you got in this business in the first place.
It's been a wild ride, I can tell you that. Basically, I spent most of my 40 years looking after policyholders, but doing so in a way that apparently I poked hornets' nests. And so I've had a challenging career, but it has also been a very successful one. About 40 years ago, I began as an examiner, and that's an insurance examiner, not a bank examiner. And I would go in and I would check the balance sheet integrity of the company to make sure that they were telling the truth in their financial statements. But I did also something called market conduct. So I did both financial condition and market conduct. The financial, it might be easy to understand, but very complex to do. The market conduct relates to how advisors, agents, fiduciaries interact with the consumer. Are they properly licensed? Are they making misrepresentations of product? So doing that for a number of years until I got accredited as a financial examiner and then certified, I became the state examiner in charge, which meant I ran all of the examinations, I supervised other examiners, and I actually wrote the report and personally signed them before they went out all over the country. And I took that as a serious business. So that led to me actually shifting from being an insurance examiner and the examiner in charge for the state. I ended up working with the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office and other federal law enforcement on a series of criminal cases, white-collar crime cases, all related to insurance companies that had collapsed because of cooking the books, wow. You know, playing with their numbers. And so that's my background.
So from my perspective, I look at myself as operating in, if you want to call it, the retail sphere. So I'm working with individual clients, families, business owners, sometimes family offices and multiple generations, but I'm working with clients on a financial planning basis. And of course, I've always looked at the financials of companies that I want to represent. I'm looking for solid balance sheets. I'm looking for long-term track records. And I'm looking for relationships with companies that I can see actually care about the welfare of the customer. And when I met you, I found it really interesting. And I thought, and I hope that our listeners and viewers will find it interesting also, that we can have someone like you who provides what I believe is a third-party, arm's-length, objective point of view from a much higher level, from a more analytical level, right, that can go behind the scenes and talk about some of the intricacies. And perhaps you'll touch on why you mentioned to me that the life and annuity industry is perhaps not as traditional and prudent an industry, right, as it once was. I really want to hear about that.
Joe, I'm not just saying this. What you just said is extremely rare. When you say, as an advisor or fiduciary, you look at the company's financials, you understand almost no one does. And I hate to say that, but a lot of agents rely on the rating agencies because it is easy. It's so easy to say, well, they've got an A, so they're good to go. But sure, it's not like that anymore. So I want to thank you for caring. And that's why I agreed to be on your program, because you know, I met you through a colleague who I really trust, and I know you care.
Yeah, and that colleague is Barry Dyke, and I have been friends with Barry for about 15 years now. Barry's written several books, the first of which introduced me to him, and in fact, Nelson Nash recommended I read the book. It's called The Pirates of Manhattan by right. Barry Dyke, and he's written several subsequent books since then. And yeah, I want to make sure that from every perspective that our clients are protected. Good. Because we put contracts into effect that we expect are going to be in effect for 100 years. So if I write a life insurance policy on a baby today, that policy is going to be here 100 years from now. And I've always relied using a whole life policy, as we say, properly designed in the context of the infinite banking concept and becoming your own banker. We rely on those guarantees, guaranteed premium, guaranteed cash value, guaranteed death benefit. Those guarantees can't be met unless the insurance company is here longer than the customer's life. So we want to have a company that's already here 100 years, that will be here another 100 years and more. And so it does concern me that, I mean, I've only been familiar with a couple demutualizations. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them have been companies that are totally solid companies. They may have gone into the demutualization camp in the 80s and 90s. And those companies are still solid. We don't even need to talk about them. I could always talk about them offline and mention them to people. Their demutualizations did not affect their financials. They didn't demutualize because they were in trouble. They demutualized because they were strong and wanted to get stronger. They wanted to dominate more of the market than they already did. But lately, there are companies that maybe are not the mutual companies that I'm working with, but they're companies that maybe have gotten a little bit greedy.
Started doing a little bit of gambling rather than the prudence we used to expect.
There you go. There you go. So why don't you talk about that? I know you've got a slide that I'm going to share.
Yeah, before we pull up the slide, let me just say something real quick.
Sure.
Some of your viewers might not understand demutualization. I just want to say quickly,
good point.
The mutual business model is as simple as it gets, and fraternals as well. Both fraternals and mutuals exist for their client, their policyholder, who is also a member or owner. But it's this simple, and it's also self-repairing, okay? Hmm. So you've got a big pot that premiums come into. Premiums start stacking up, and then claims start coming out. So you have premiums from your members and claims paying those same members. So it is literally just a balancing of premiums and claims with, obviously, you have to have some administrative expenses, employees and the building and so forth. But with a mutual or a fraternal, that is typically a budgeted item, right? So it's reasonable. As long as format, it works. Now, Joe, as I'm a certified fraud examiner, and I have to say, in any industry, if you've got a guy or a woman who want to execute some sort of fraud scheme, there's nothing you can do about that, right? But in a mutual absent fraud, the mutual will always self-repair because if the claims are higher than premiums in a given year or a period of years, the members understand you got to go up on the premiums. But if you have several years where you're making money, you have premiums stacking up faster than claims take it out, that's returned to the member in policyholder refunds, premium refunds, policyholder dividends, that sort of thing. So over time, it will always work. It's worked for hundreds of years. If you could go back to Europe. So that works. When the demutualizations began about 40 years ago in the U.S., that was right when I was becoming a young examiner. So I lived through this. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this before we look at the slides. Once a company goes from a mutual that is purely policyholder centric. When they become for profit, think about that. There is a new mouth to feed, and that mouth is an investor or the investors. Many of them are institutional. And believe me, that mouth at the table is louder and hungrier than the policyholders, unfortunately. So what has happened is over the last number of decades, those companies, because the money was coming out of that pot to go to investors, where was that coming from? It's coming out of the pot that used to self-balance. And if you start taking money out for something else to pay an investor or a big bonus, it's going to leave a company with a balance sheet that becomes more fragile. And if it becomes fragile, it cannot pay stockholder dividends. Mm-hmm. And they want to be able to pay dividends. And once they get started, they kind of have to, they feel like they have to keep paying dividends to keep the stock price up. So what do? They play around a bit. They get what I call sleight of hand, reinsurance, things like that, that in the early years, they just do a little bit, but it starts feeling good. And before you know it, some of the more aggressive for-profits who have demutualized became much riskier and more. So with that in mind, what I wanted to do is show you a couple of slides that I just created for a client. But this is public information. So if you'd pull it up, okay. I'll help you through it quickly.
Okay. So I've got slide number one here.
Okay. So what I've done here is I've compared two life and annuity carriers. One is Athene Annuity and Life Company. It's domiciled in Iowa. And New York Life is domiciled in New York. Athene hasn't been around nearly as long, but people are beginning to hear about them. New York Life has been around a long time, and they are a bona fide mutual. And I have to say, and by the way, I don't have a dog in this hunt, and my understanding is you don't either. You don't represent these companies. So I just want to be clear, I'm as neutral as they get. New York Life has had around $200 billion in total liabilities. Athene, just in the last year, jumped by $55 billion in liabilities in 1 year to the $199 billion mark you see there. So you look at the graph, those are the liabilities. Those are the promises made by these companies. And you notice they are very similar. Yep. They didn't used to be. Just a year ago, Athene was only around 145 or so. But given that these two companies are very comparable in total liabilities, I would expect some of their ratios to be similar. If you would go to the second slide, I want to show you why I wanted to show these slides. Same two companies. We just showed you they had roughly almost the exact same amount of liabilities. But this surplus, that's the safety buffer. It is the little bit of extra money above the liabilities. So for simplicity's sake, you take total assets, subtract all those promises, those liabilities, and you get surplus. That surplus, in my professional opinion, is the most important number in that annual statement. That is the buffer that protects the policyholders. Now, look at that. Right beneath the graph, I say of approximately 700 U.S. life and annuity carriers, the national average is about 7.5%. That is surplus to liabilities. So we just simply take surplus divided by liabilities, and that's a good benchmark for your long-term promises. And look at the difference. You got $2.8 billion Athene and $25.3 billion with New York Life. I give you the numbers there. While the national average is 7.5, Athene is 1.44%. And you see there, New York is almost 12 and a quarter. it tells a story on its own, doesn't it?
Sure it does.
What does it make you think, Joe?
Well, it makes me think that obviously the advisors have a duty, as you mentioned, a fiduciary duty, to look deeper at the companies that are offering products for our clients. And I have a duty to look not only at the glossy brochures that they're sending us, whether it's paper or digital, right?
Right.
I need to look beyond the story that they're telling, beyond maybe, if you want to make it as simple as rate of return that's being advertised in a particular product, and look at the assets that are underlying those promises to make sure that the company has the ability to fulfill those promises.
Exactly. Very well said. What would you like to talk about next? You want to continue with our slides? They continue the same storyline as my notes.
Yep.
By the way, thank you for having me on today. Unfortunately, not enough people are aware of what we're talking about. In fact, almost no one, the people that fill these statements out themselves, almost no one understands these intricacies.
Sure.
I wanted to put this up is so that you know and your listeners know that I only work directly from the company's own sworn statutory annual statements. It is the only source document to use if your concern is financial viability into the long term, right? What I showed as the first slide is that total liabilities, line 28 at the top there. Mm-hmm. You see they're around $199 billion. You saw that in the graph. You also see number two there, the blue 2.875 is their surplus, which means you add the liabilities and that surplus, and that's how you get the $201.9 billion in assets. I do want to point out, but you know, I mentioned that some companies are more aggressive than others. Just quickly, take a look at bullet number three. You've got, these are write-ins, Joe. And just a few years back, write-ins were tiny. The write-ins are what they sound like. If you can't fit it elsewhere on the balance sheet, you just write in. It used to be, if anything, it would be small. Look at this. The first one, line 2501, derivative and other collateral liability. $3.3 billion. The one derivative, and I'm sure your readers or listeners know, we're talking volatility there, right? Derivatives. The next is repo liability, repurchase agreement. Then another derivative liability item. And then some overflows. Look at that. It's $6.72 billion in highly volatile liabilities against $2.88 billion in surplus. And so what I want to point out to everyone is, here is why that surplus is so important. If a liability increases, like these volatile ones here, or if the assets decrease, let's say you've got a portfolio of high-risk assets like CLOs or whatever. If those have to be written down, that also comes out of surplus. So as your estimates and your values are in flux, let's say you have an economic stress event. These companies are going to start seeing these values change. That's why you want a large buffer. So if you'll go to the next slide, I want to show you New York Life's same thing.
Just before I go to the next slide, I want to ask you one question. It looks like from the prior year to the current year, their write-ins went from $5.2 billion to $6.7 billion. So that's about a 30% increase.
Good point.
So is the motivation of the company to just attract more clients because of their sheer size?
I don't believe that's the primary objective. Companies that are mutual, that exist for their policyholders, have a different business model. They want to invest well. They want to earn a good return so that the value of the company will build to pay future claims. But sometimes these companies are owned by a private equity group, a group that is historically known to be interested in quick profits over long-term value.
Sure.
In this case, if the private equity group, here it's Apollo Global, they make more money by having more assets to manage. And when they bought Athene Annuity, the insurance company, Apollo made sure that Athene signed up with Apollo to do their investment management. So the bigger they get, the more assets they manage, but also the more funds that they can do things with. You follow me?
Gotcha.
And the next slide is just like this, only it's New York Life. I want to make sure y'all realize I compare apples to apples. Mm-hmm. This is the exact same snapshot. And you see, they have a little bit more in liabilities, but look at their surplus, $25.3 billion. And last year, it was almost $24 billion. I have to say, I have nothing to do with New York Life, other than I admire that they've stuck to. By the way, this is an interesting story, Joe. Years ago, back when MetLife had just demutualized, some big-time investment bankers met with the top execs at New York Life and practically begged them to demutualize. And I spoke to the vice president at New York Life, and he was proud to say they spent more than a year and a lot of money in a due diligence to see if they should do that. And at the end of that time, New York Life said, under all of the scenarios we've looked at, we do not see how demutualizing would be a good thing for our policyholders. So they said no, but they didn't just say no. They looked at it. They analyzed it. And by saying no, that gives New York Life this kind of solid balance sheet. They don't have to answer to investors. They don't have to pay money out to investment management groups for whatever. And notice in the right ends, New York Life has some derivatives collateral liability. They, just like Athene, they purchase derivatives mostly for hedging, is my guess, probably all for hedging. But look at it. First of all, the numbers are a lot smaller, 1.48 in total versus $25 billion. So there's a major difference here. Now, I got to say, some mutuals are more aggressive. They are a little more aggressive in their investing, but they're still policyholder centric. The fraternals, even more so. So between the mutuals and the fraternals, I see an overall pattern of basically more traditional. In the private equity controlled, I see much more aggressive as a general pattern. I think that's fair to say, because okay. I've looked at the data.
Yep.
And go ahead to the next slide, if you would. All right, I won't spend much time on this, but it's worth, maybe we can talk about it in another program.
Sure.
Joe, because this is really important. I can't stress that enough. This is in 2024, you notice, this is Athene speaking to its stock analysts and other investor-related professionals. And they're showing how they have shifted from 11% in funding agreements to 38% in funding agreements. And the reason that matters, and I want you to be aware of it, is that funding agreements used to be called GICs, G-I-C, Guaranteed Interest Contracts. You might remember in 2008, AIG got in some trouble. Mm-hmm. AIG, it wasn't just their credit default swaps. They had put out a ton of these GICs. Now, the reason that's an issue is those are known as literally deposit-type contracts, meaning the money might not be there long at all. They might be in there 1 month, maybe less. So if, here's what bothers me and why this really matters. If there is a global or country economic event that shows stress on liquidity, I want you to think about it. The people purchasing these funding agreements are extremely sophisticated institutional investors, like mutual funds and pension plans. They're buying these funding agreements in the billions of dollars. And the reason that's a concern is that those institutional investors will become aware of a threat to liquidity, a so-called run on the bank, before the policyholders will, and likely even before the regulators will. My concern is if they demand from Athene their money back, my concern is they'll have to give it to them, because if they don't, that might precipitate a run on the bank. So the reason this is a big picture is this is a, it's not Gober saying this, there's a great research paper put out by the Federal Reserve talking about a run on the bank and insurance companies and the threat of these very instruments, funding agreements. And if you'll go to the next slide, I think we're almost done here. Yep.
Can you make that paper available to me?
I absolutely will. Then, I'll send it to you this afternoon.
And then for anybody who's interested, if, with your permission, I'll share that.
Excellent. Oh, of course. It's a public document. Good. Everything I share on these are public documents. Now, this is interesting to me. This is really, really important. There is a tendency for the population to forget history. And I've been around, I've been doing this for 40 years. So I remember Baldwin United. A lot of your customers may not. But we've got to start learning from the past. Look at what I wrote here. This is my language first. What happens when an insurance company grows much faster than its financial infrastructure is built to handle and does so using complex financial maneuvers? Look at the headline on that. This is from 1983. Mm-hmm. When Baldwin United collapsed, they say a casualty of fast expansion. They had to file for bankruptcy. And look at the last line down there. The casualty of overexpansion built on complex financial maneuvers. Now, this was a company that started small, and they were in Arkansas. I actually know a lot about this because my mentor, when I was a kid, when I started as an examiner, my mentor had been the examiner in charge on the examination that took Baldwin down. So he taught me a lot about this. Because that is a story from 1983, Joe, and it talks about fast expansion, would you go back to slide three just one more time for just a minute? I want to show you what fast expansion means. All right. Look at total liabilities in column two, prior year. They jumped from 143 billion to 199 billion in 1 year. Now, you guys might not see that as a lot. It is enormous in the insurance industry. No, they surged up 55.6 billion in 1 year. That same mentor that examined Baldwin United and taught me how to be a good examiner, he said, the first thing he taught me is, Tom, an insurance company cannot grow itself out of a hole. Mm-hmm. The deeper the hole gets, the more conservative you have to become, not more aggressive. Because every time you write all this new business, you have new expenses, commissions, underwriting, and that sort of thing. So I just want everyone to be aware, we need to remember Baldwin United, Executive Life. Executive Life was using offshore reinsurance before most people had even heard of it. So I want everybody to realize some of these things were done in the past, and when they were done in the past, they didn't turn out well. Okay?
Well, when you think about anything that's offshore, to me, not being in your category, the thing that occurs to me is offshore means we don't have our government oversight. We don't have accountability. We don't know if they're cooking the books offshore. There's got to be a reason why they took things offshore. Good things don't happen in the daylight. They happen in the dark, right?
Yeah. You're so right, Joe. And I wasn't going to get into that. And maybe on a future podcast, we can talk about this a little bit more. But since you brought it up, offshore reinsurance has become massive. It's more than $2 trillion of the life and annuity industry.
Interesting.
Has been moved to Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, Barbados, even Malta, believe it or not. And what does that mean? It means that we have no idea what's there. They do not file statutory statements like you're looking at here. By the way, Athene's annual statement at year-end 2023 was about 4,000 pages. There is a ton of detail. It has to be. We got to see which bonds. We got to see which stocks. What kind of policies are they selling? The statement from offshore might be 56 pages. It's an audited financial statement where it says bonds, dollar amount, not which individual bonds. So because we can't see that, all we can do is guess. And I don't like guessing. So I'm concerned about this shift to offshore reinsurance.
Right.
In fact, I tell advisors, if I tell policyholders, if an advisor pushes a product on you with a given carrier, the first thing I would ask if I was a policyholder is, do they go offshore a bunch? That's all they got to ask. And the advisor won't know. Which is why I ask that they ask that. The advisor will not know, and the policyholder should say, well, then please find out. They'll go and they'll see a ton offshore, wow. And there you have it.
Wow.
I'm worried about that, okay?
So in wrapping up today, obviously there's a lot of technical conversation going on here, and I would encourage any financial professional who's interested in meeting Tom, corresponding with him, to connect with me. Give me a call at my office. Go to our website, put an inquiry in there. I will also put this video on our website at alphaomegawealth.com, so you'll have access to it. And it may be that 95% of people won't have the interest in learning about these things. But at a certain point, the more concerned you are about your financial future, the more serious you're going to have to be in going into the detail and finding out exactly who's helping you with your money. So the way I like to describe myself, for example, is not a money manager, but it's more of a coach or of a facilitator or a counselor, an advisor, a cheerleader to encourage you to take ownership of the financial literacy that needs to exist in your family.
Excellent.
Because if you don't own the financial literacy, your kids are not going to be interested in owning it. And you're going to be, in a sense, subject to the preferences, and they might just be casual preferences, of some salesperson, and I use the term loosely, who might be more interested in gaining a commission or a fee than they are in how your family is doing financially for the next 50 and 100 years. If the advisor is more interested in you and is interested in fulfilling a fiduciary capacity, that advisor is going to want to put their financial success behind yours. I can't be successful unless I help you become successful.
So, if I could just say one thing, yes, Joe, one last word about that. I believe that advisors are always trying to find a niche that sets them apart. And I think that's a good thing. Let this be one of those things that sets you apart, because if you do the deep dive, or you have someone do this analysis for you, and you know for sure you're picking companies that are going to live longer than your client,
mm-hmm.
you've done a good thing, but you've also got those policyholders are going to know because they've been pitched by others. They're going to know that you care more than the others. And I think that is what it's all about, frankly.
There you go.
All right.
So I appreciate talking with you today. We are definitely going to do a follow-up. This deserves a follow-up or more than one. So thank you for being with us, Tom. And for you out there, hope you'll follow us at Make Your Wealth Work and the Alpha Omega Wealth Channel. Thanks.
Thank you, Joe.
This is the PodcastFactory.com.